From York to Altoona, Danville to Lebanon, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it is budget time in Harrisburg with new players and new agendas at the negotiating table. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capital Watch roundtable discussion with Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. And it was 30 years ago this month, the Lincoln Institute was founded with a mission to take the pulse of Pennsylvania. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. The race for the Democratic nomination for Pennsylvania Attorney General is beginning to take shape. Last week, former State Auditor General Eugene DePasquale announced that he will seek his party's nomination. This week, former Bucks County Solicitor Joe Kahn announced his candidacy. Governor Josh Shapiro resigned the office earlier this year when he was sworn in as the state's new chief executive and was replaced by Michelle Henry, who will complete the remainder of his term. All three constitutional or row offices are up for election next year, including Attorney General, Auditor General, and State Treasurer. Auditor General Tim DeFore and State Treasurer Stacey Garrity are expected to seek re-election. The Center Square reports that Pennsylvania's emergency services are facing a serious financial crisis and are having difficulty recruiting first responders. The fire service in particular is having difficulty finding enough volunteers. That, along with a lack of dedicated funding streams for many local departments, has pushed the situation, quote, past a crisis mode, end quote, according to Whitehall Township Fire Chief David Nelson, who testified this past week before a State House committee. Burnout and PTSD are also becoming more of a problem. Legislators are considering a review of rules and regulations to lessen the training burden and are discussing solutions to the funding problem. The Pennsylvania State House of Representatives is now back to a full roster of 203 members, with the swearing-in this past week of two lawmakers elected in special elections during the May primary. Democrat Heather Boyd of Delaware County and Republican Michael Stender of Northumberland and Montour counties took their seats in the lower chamber. Their presence maintains the narrow one-seat majority held by Democrats. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The deadline for enacting a new Pennsylvania state budget is June 30th, and with a new governor and new leaders in both houses of the legislature, the negotiations this year will take on a different tone. Here to discuss the ins and outs of the budget process are David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, who is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation, and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me on the program, your Capital Watch All-Stars, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, thanks for being on the show.
So glad to be back here with you, Dave. Thanks.
Great to be with you. And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
Fantastic to be with you, David.
Well, it's, you know, these are exciting times in Harrisburg. We are now in the month of June, which all of the politicos know that's budget month, that the constitutional deadline for the state budget is supposedly June 30. Now, there's always some wiggle room there. It's not like the blade falls at midnight, but the goal is to try to get it done on time. And so the gears are now turning that the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Democrats, the 203-seat chamber is 102 Democrat, 101 Republican, and it was by that very same margin that the Democrats passed their version of the budget. Steve, what was in that?
So we've seen a couple of offers now on what the budget will contain. First, Governor Shapiro put out his budget proposal, which is not legislation. It's not anything that has any force of law, but it's just his idea for what the budget should be. So he started the process with that. Now the Democratic majority in the House has answered with its own idea of what should be in the budget. And what they did was layer on a whole lot of extra new spending on top of what Governor Shapiro had already asked for.
Steve, it was only $1 billion. In the previous budget go-rounds that you had, the House Democrat caucus, when they were in the minority, that they wanted to take all of the, you know, the Biden bucks that hadn't been spent yet and the things that had been stored away in the rainy day fund. They were like chucking away money with both hands. Like they wanted to spend it all at once, which of course would then, you know, take the baseline of spending way up, but leave no reserves to actually pay for that ongoing spending. And so this stunt that they pulled, it looks a lot like that.
In this budget that the House Democrats passed, and it was strictly on party line votes, 102 Democrats voted for it as necessary to advance it, it reflects a lack of regard for the future. It's very present focused. There is money sitting around in some of the funds that were left over from the COVID era. We have money in the rainy day fund substantially for the first time in many years. And the proposal that the Democrats have made just wipes all that out.
Mm-hmm.
It starts to drain the rainy day fund again. It puts us on a path. It has a $3 billion deficit. So in several years, it puts us on a path of the state's going to need either some sort of radical spending cuts, which we know are very difficult to implement, or it's going to do what's easier for it as a government to do, increase taxes on our citizens, on the folks who do business here in our state, which is a recipe for continued economic struggle.
As we look at these budgets that go up every year, we know every year there's an increase in the state budget, and you can't think about it in the present day, just exactly what he was saying there. You can't think about it in the present day. You have to think about it in the future. So next year, we have to say the budget increases, you know, X percent this year. So next year, you have to look at X percent plus Y percent. And that continues in the future. So you have to find a revenue source, like Steve said, that also increases X percent plus Y percent along with those budgets. So assuming we don't get any budget cuts, which, as Steve said, is almost impossible. But that's just critically important because we're layering spending on top of spending and we don't have revenue that's sufficient to support that going forward.
That's exactly right. And as the listeners have heard before, Pennsylvania has what is known as a structural deficit, which is there's mandatory spending programs, things where if people qualify for the benefits, they automatically get them. It's not something that's budgeted. And those those categories are increasing faster than the natural growth of the economy. So and again, these are promises that have been made to our seniors and other people who are in need. We have to honor those obligations. It just, you've got to look at the budgeting process through that prism, because unless we find a way to accelerate economic growth by improving business conditions, that structural deficit is going to continue to widen.
Well, it's either that or raise taxes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, no, exactly. But even then, it's a downward spiral because it's,
yes,
like if you increase taxes,
right,
you're increasing the burden on the productive sector,
yeah,
including just like people in their working years. And you're putting more pressure on those folks and making it more likely that they, go somewhere else to build lives and careers and raise their families, which is going to deepen that problem.
And we're looking at, in that budget that the Democrats just passed, their offer to the Senate and the governor as to what they can pass in their chamber, it's a 14% spending hike over the past year's budget. Now, we've all suffered through a year or so of the Biden inflation. We've seen rapid increase in costs of all kinds. But even that, for the most part, hasn't been anything close to 14%. Why in the world would be giving the government and essentially the whole structure of state government a raise of 14% at a time when consumers are struggling, taxpayers are struggling, prices are going up? This is also an inflationary move to drastically increase spending like this.
Yes.
Increase liquidity in the economy, pour more dollars out there that we don't really have to spend. It's a recipe for ongoing trouble, not only in terms of, as you talked about, that long-term fiscal outlook, but even for right now.
Yes.
It's a problem for today.
We talk about more spending on any given thing as though more money automatically means better results. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. That's never the case by default. It's always a matter of how are the resources deployed? What kind of value do the taxpayers get for the money that's spent? It's harder to operate a system that demands results, that, you know, imposes accountability. That's what we need a whole lot more of. And it's because it's not just about the, you know, the voodoo of spending more and more and more every time.
Every time that does happen, it's putting our state at a disadvantage that we have talked about on this program before. We've got a brain drain situation. We've got a labor force drain situation. The employers that either are in Pennsylvania or are considering coming to Pennsylvania, they look at our environment. They see the population's dropping.
Mm-hmm.
The skilled labor force is leaving the state.
Mm-hmm.
The tax rates are onerous. The tax system is onerous. The regulatory system is especially onerous and difficult to comply with. Even if you really try as hard as you can to comply,
yep.
Pennsylvania makes it difficult. When you look at all that, what's going to happen when a company that is, again, either here now or is considering coming here, looks around and realizes that if they go to North Carolina or mm-hmm. Florida mm-hmm. or Arizona, they'll find a much lighter regulatory burden. They'll find a much lighter and easier to manage tax burden. They'll find that the labor force is booming, population mm-hmm. is growing.
Right.
Clout on the national issues is growing as congressional representation increases while ours decreases and we get weaker. This is a cycle that's dangerous, not just for the next few years. This is dangerous for our kids. So I guess the question I wanted to bring up today is, these are all bad things. It sounds rather dire. And this budget that the Democrats just advanced through their chamber, through the House chamber, is dire. But there is a bulwark, and that is our Pennsylvania Senate. The Pennsylvania Senate is controlled by the Republicans right now by a substantial majority. And so far in this process, they have been the voices of reason.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. And the Senate Republican caucus, they have a new leadership team. It's not about price, it's about value. And this hallucination that just spending more on something makes that something better or deals with that problem better. It's not necessarily so. And again, the rate at which state government has grown, that whenever government grows faster than the private economy, it suffocates economic growth. Like, the overspending itself is actually a competitiveness issue. I mean, this is why we've sought spending restraints like the Taxpayer Protection Act to limit the increase in the general fund to inflation plus population growth, just to have some kind of real world metric to rein in the rate at which state government can expand. Like, what's the total spend number on that budget that the House D's passed?
$47 billion.
Okay, so like, when I came to town in the late 90s, the general fund budget was like around $20 billion.
Yeah, it was 22 when I started in Harrisburg.
See like the relentless increase, like, do you think government's twice as effective today as it was back then? I wish I could believe that, but I don't think so.
Well, the bigger question is, and I get why you're stuck on this issue, Dave, because that $20 billion extra dollars that it's increased since the time that you've been here is taxpayer money. So the question is, who spends that money better, and where do you find better value from its expenditure?
Yes.
Letting it to taxpayers to allocate to the resources that they find to be most of value,
yes,
in our economy, or giving it to the government and letting them allocate the resources. So that issue of value, I think, is very important.
And I think it's also in terms of providing benefits to people in need.
Of course.
That the purpose is to help people to return to self-sufficiency if possible. And that it seems as though the current system, the way that it's structured, is designed to breed dependency, to keep people down and to make them rely upon that support from government, and that for that reason they will then support politically the party of government.
And when you mentioned, David, that that budget had grown during your tenure as a person close to the process in Harrisburg,
yeah,
over that period of time, the acceleration, the growth of state government spending has far exceeded inflation. It's not as if, oh, it just grew along at the usual 2 or 3% inflation rate we had for most of that time period.
Yep.
It didn't do that. It grew much faster than that.
Yes.
And as you pose the question, that makes so much sense and is a good one for folks to think about, is our government that much better now than it was? And it clearly isn't. I mean, everyone would laugh. There's nobody of any party that I think would not laugh at that question. And so then what are we doing?
Right.
And what are we doing? And are we being smart? And going back to what we are doing, I talked a little bit about the Senate leadership team that we're really counting on to hold the line against the proposal. First, this very large proposal from Governor Shapiro. Now this mega proposal from the House Democrats,
yes,
that exceeds even by far what Governor Shapiro wanted.
Yes.
This bulwark of Senate leadership, and I'm talking about people like President Pro Tem Kim Ward, Senate Majority Leader Joe Pitman, Senate Majority Appropriations Chairman Scott Martin. They are looking at things very carefully, and I know there are a number of areas where they are doing the very thing you just talked about.
Yeah.
One of those being an issue that's very near and dear to the Commonwealth Foundation, which is educational choice and educational opportunity in Pennsylvania. And how can we expand access to better education for Pennsylvania children without just throwing more money at the problem, which hasn't helped at all?
Right.
In fact, things have gotten worse.
Exactly.
And with
school choice and more educational opportunities, we are introducing, or we intend to introduce, that kind of consumer choice, market competition, that's how we get accountability in the system, whereby, you know, if parents are displeased with the quality of the educational experience that their student is having at that school, they can move their kid, and that the money goes with that student.
And that sort of competition has been proven over and over again to actually produce better results, not only for the kids who find an alternative option, but for the kids who stay in traditional district public schools. It works out to help everyone because of, again, the American principle of competition.
Well, and we've seen that, and I know I use this example too often, but it's just so perfect. Like, I think we can all remember days gone by, the truly spectacular inefficiency of the U.S. Postal Service, and that I think that most folks would recognize that today it's less bad than it was in the past, and I would attribute that directly to competition from from UPS and FedEx and DHL and Amazon and these others. It's like it showed that there was another way forward, and it also brought pressure on the system to say, look, if we don't shake things up, we're really going to get left behind. And like, that's the dynamic that we need to bring about more efficiency, more accountability with this massive spending.
So we're going to see, I think, how the process unfolds from here. We're going to see at some point the Senate essentially answer the proposal from the House chamber that the Democrats sent over. And I from everything I'm hearing, and I try not to be biased when I listen for, try to find out what's happening in Harrisburg. Like, it's my job to know what's going on, and I try to take the bad news where there's bad news and good news where there's good news, and not try to force it into a place that it isn't. I think there will be some good news when the Republicans answer. I think you're going to see something that's much more sound, fiscally reasonable, advances some of those principles you were talking about of greater efficiencies, reforming some of the biggest cost drivers like the Medicaid program under Human Services Department.
Yes, yes.
Places where there's opportunity to make the system more efficient and smarter and actually get better results.
Yeah. And Rebecca, the thing, I'm you're probably aware of this too, the thing I think that Steve is alluding to is that that the federal government, there's a window of reviewing the roles of who is on Medicaid and who qualifies for benefits, that every so often that we're allowed to go back and look at the rolls and make sure that the people who are currently getting benefits are eligible for them. I really hope that Governor Shapiro and his administration have the resolve to undergo the rigors of that process and actually, you know, make sure that those dollars are only going to the people that they're supposed to be there to help.
Well, I had heard that the Republicans in the House had introduced some amendments to the budget bill that would have tamped down on fraud and abuse of this, of some aspects of the state budget, some aspects of the state agencies, and that those amendments were voted down.
Yeah.
In the chamber, so they did not make it into the bill. So maybe some of those ideas will come back up in the Senate. Hopefully we'll have to see that. But as for where we go from here, the Senate comes back with its answer, and then we have to eventually get both houses to agree and a governor to agree. So it might be a long, you know, process here over the summer.
Now, there's no rule that they have to start the negotiations in time to get them done. And so they tend to put it off until there's either no time left or very little.
Right.
Well, that, and that's what we're looking at for the next couple of weeks.
Yes, yes. And, you know, again, over many years, that is the way things have worked, that it, the pressure of that deadline, that's the anvil against which everybody hammers to try to beat that budget into shape. So anyway, as ever, it's highly entertaining to have a front row at the circus, but I'm glad that I'm here with you guys. We're winding down to the end of this program. Absolutely, absolutely. Cotton candy, the whole thing. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org on the web.
Wonderful. Rebecca, where can folks go to learn more about you and your organization?
They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at pmta.org.
Wonderful. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. It all started in November of 1992 with dinner and a napkin. Yes, a napkin. You've seen thousands of them, those plain white paper napkins used in restaurants everywhere. It was at that dinner when the late Al Pascal and I conceived the idea of a nonprofit educational institute. We wrote the business plan on a napkin. We were officially incorporated in June of 1993 as the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, with a mission, quote, dedicated to promoting the ideals of free market economics, individual liberty, and limited government through the conduct of public opinion research and related educational outreach projects. In the 1990s, the conservative movement in Pennsylvania was nowhere near as robust as it is today. Key organizations such as the Commonwealth Foundation and the Pennsylvania Family Institute had only recently been founded, and the infrastructure needed to produce a pro-growth state economy had yet to be formed. Into that mix entered the Lincoln Institute, with an initial emphasis on public opinion polling and the conduct of focus groups designed to bring the views of we the people into the public policy debate. After setting up the Lincoln Institute's legal structure, Al Pascal and I reached out to Charles L. Skip Houston, who had lobbied in both Harrisburg and Washington, D.C., on behalf of his family business, Luke and Steele, and who had taken a larger role in his family's philanthropic foundations. The Houston Foundation and the Stuart Houston Charitable Trust then provided the startup funding needed to launch the Lincoln Institute. Additional early funding was provided by Pittsburgh publisher and national conservative donor Richard M. Scaife through the Allegheny Foundation and from William Box at the McKenna Foundation, both longtime friends of mine from my earlier days in Westmoreland County politics. With the funding base secure, the time had come to expand the Lincoln Institute's board of directors. Al Pascal, Jane Gordon, Skip Houston, and I formed the initial board, and we quickly added more Westmoreland County friends, the late Robert Keebler, Hillary Holste, along with Doris Buffet and Joanne Beyer of the Allegheny Foundation. Very soon thereafter, additional key board members were elected, including the late Frederick W. Anton III, who helmed the influential Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. Marcia Ord, who became the organization's longtime board secretary, Joe Geiger from the Pennsylvania Association of Nonprofit Organizations, and Susan Staub from Pennsylvanians for Right to Work. With the governance of the organization set, the Lincoln Institute began conducting statewide polling and public opinion court focus group sessions. The late Al Sinlinger conducted daily economic polling for national clients and provided a state-level subset to the Lincoln Institute. Our first newsletter was titled The Lincoln Institute Sinlinger Economic Report and later retitled as Lincoln Journal. Almost immediately, the semi-annual Keystone Business Climate Survey was established. The survey of owners and top-line executives of businesses based in Penns Woods has been conducted every spring and fall ever since and has become an accurate, dependable bellwether of economic conditions in the Commonwealth. About this time, the Lincoln Institute began expanding more into educational outreach projects with the production of Lincoln Radio Journal. The half-hour public affairs radio program was first a monthly show, which expanded to weekly with the addition of the Capital Watch segment, first hosted by Jim Panyard of the PMA. The Lincoln Radio Journal Network grew steadily to over 90 stations, inspiring the advent of the Lincoln Institute's first national venture, American Radio Journal, in 2008. American Radio Journal now airs on over 270 stations nationwide and on popular podcast platforms. The rise of the internet provided a vehicle to more quickly disseminate information, so newsletter publication ceased, and the Institute launched patownhall.com. Many other organizations wanted to contribute, so patownhall.com became a platform for numerous conservative organizations and columnists to provide content to what has become Pennsylvania's marketplace of ideas. The Lincoln Institute has grown steadily in both reach and impact. The radical environmental front group Energy and Policy Institute published what they termed an expose, claiming that the Lincoln Institute is, quote, prominent and at the head of an intertwined network. That network is opposing what we see as the job-crushing regional greenhouse gas initiative. The left-wing website Eyes on the Ties concluded that we are, quote, a powerful figure in Harrisburg. Our board of directors, too, has changed over the years, and as we observe our 30th anniversary, I would like to thank State Senator Kristen Phillips Hill, who serves as our vice chair, our treasurer, Albert Beanstalk, Secretary Marcia Ord, Joe Geiger, Colin Hanna, Dr. Jake Hauck, Dr. Paul Kangor, Andrew Lewis, Frank Ryan, and David Taylor, who currently serve on our board of directors. I would also like to acknowledge the contributions of my wife, Carol Henry, my son, Tyler Henry, our radio production assistant, Joe Winters, and Ryan Shafiq, who helped to launch American Radio Journal. Much has changed over 30 years, but what has not changed is the admonition of Thomas Jefferson, who observed that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. That will continue to be our task. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WFRJ-FM in Windburr, WEDO-AM in White Oak, along with WRYV-FM in State College, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom help to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
We'll be right back.